Good morning, everyone. This, as you know, is our, see, what number are we at? Seventh office hours in the Patent Law and Global Public Health course. As usual, I'm happy to entertain any questions you might have concerning either the logistics of the course or substance. And I will, as usual, record the session and post the recording on the homepage for the course. The links to those recordings are now located at the bottom of the homepage. So as usual, I'm happy to take questions in the order presented, either live by using the raise hand function, or in the chat. So, who wants to start? No questions this week. It's all perfectly clear. Mateo.
Sorry to be me always, teacher, professor.
Okay.
As always, thank you for your time. So I have two questions. And the first was about the graphics of the prices when they dropped. I was wondering if it was because the course is all about patents, but trademark and trade dress attached to the product also give premium prices even before the patent got expired. Remember the Bayer case with aspirin, that they blended, they peel really good with the colors and with the name aspirin to make a quite distinction when the patents what expired, and they continue with premium prices after the patent. So the first question was about that. But wondering if the charts only show the prices behavior if the patent is still going or not, just because the course, or that also the trademark and the trade dress gives that premium prices. And the second one is about the COVID vaccine patents. I don't know if there is still, or there is, if there are patent granted on COVID vaccines, because as you recall, patents take 2-3 years to get granted, and we're in the third year after pandemic. So I'm guessing if the last year some patents were granted to COVID vaccines, and if they were, why? And well, that's it, Bishop. Thank you.
Two very good questions. So I'll answer the second one briefly, because we're going to be returning to that issue in 2 weeks. So the short answer to the second question is yes, there are lots of patents on the various COVID vaccines, of which the two most important are the Pfizer and Moderna mRNA vaccines, widely considered to be the most effective of the vaccines. And so, the patent situation there is the most significant. So the short answer is the family of patents on those vaccines began quite a while ago. The relevant companies sought protection for different elements of the platforms that they were building. So even though, as you point out, the products are not that old, the accumulation of patents gives both companies a substantial portfolio. Now, the reason why I'm not going to pursue this issue further is because in 2 weeks, when we discuss intellectual property reform, the primary case study for discussion that week will be the COVID vaccine waiver, the proposal to suspend the relevant portions of the TRIPS agreement to permit developing countries to make use of the relevant technologies in ways they could not otherwise. So, because we'll be talking then about the relevant technologies, we'll come back to it in more detail. I should say there's the case study on that topic is being prepared by Jayashree Watal, who's an expert in this field. So we'll come back to that one. Now, with respect to your first question, this is interesting and subtle. You were referring, I take it, to the slides I showed in the recorded lecture that indicate the typical trajectory of a drug that has patent protection. So just to review briefly so everybody's on the same page, the lifespan, the commercial lifespan of the typical drug, excluding for a moment central nervous system drugs, which are different, but the typical commercial lifespan of a ordinary small molecule drug is about 12 years. And with remarkable consistency, what happens over those 12 years is the price gradually goes up, not so gradually goes up, and the volume of sales also gradually go up. So the result is that the through the combination of price and volume, the innovator is making the most money in the last year of the commercial life of the drug. Okay, then what happens? Well, the patent, in the simplest case, expires. Let's exclude for the moment the complexities associated with evergreening, and let's imagine just in the basic case, the patent expires. You might think at that point that the price of the drug would drop radically because now the innovator is faced with generic competition. Remember that in most jurisdictions, including the United States, the generics can prepare for launch even during the period of the patent protection. So they're ready to go right at the expiration of the patent. So you might think, well, generics would arrive on the market. And first of all, competition among the generics would keep their prices down. And the innovator would have to lower its price sharply if it wanted to sell any more drugs, because now there are identical versions on the market. And that doesn't happen. Instead, what you see is a gradual diminution in the price of the innovator. So your question, I take it, is why? Why does the innovator retain some power even after the expiration of the patent? And there are a combination of forces at work here that vary somewhat by jurisdiction. One of them, as you point out, is trademark protection and trade dress protection. So the innovator can continue to refer to its drug using one of the invented names that they conventionally use. And usually, although this is a complex issue in trademark law, usually can maintain exclusivity over coloring and so forth, just so long as it's not functional. And those two things together retain its reputational power in the market. And as you point out, the Bayer aspirin case is a good manifestation of the extraordinary power of reputation, even though for a very long time, it's been true that chemically identical versions of aspirin have been available in the drugstores, still people will pay twice as much for Bayer aspirin as they will for generic aspirin because of the lure and luster of the brand. Now, here's an extra factor. In some jurisdictions, including the United States, the capacity of insurers to force doctors to shift from prescribing the innovator to generics is limited in practice. And why is it limited? Well, because the consumers are more captivated by the luster of the brand than our doctors. Doctors are quicker to recognize the substitutability of the generics, but the consumers don't want to shift because they've heard of the branded version. They want the branded version. And that puts competitive pressure indirectly on insurers to not force the issue. So even though the folks who are in the most knowledgeable position, namely the doctors, would be inclined to opt for substitutes, it's the patients who are generally speaking price insensitive because they've already paid their insurance policies, who will preserve a substantial portion of the market for the innovator. So that's the primary explanation for the slow decline, slower than one would expect. Okay, and then there are a few extra factors. One of them you may have studied last week is the reverse payment settlement agreements, which sometimes slow the processes by which generics show up. And the other is advertising. So the pharmaceutical firms, as you likely know, spend as much money on advertising typically as they do on research and development. And they strive with some success through their advertising to hold the attention of consumers to their brands. Whereas generally speaking, the generics do not spend significant amounts of advertising, so they don't pull people.
That's what I thought, like maybe when generics enter to the market, yeah, maybe the patentee may lose market share because new players in the game. But if I continue my advertising campaign and make my brand solid, as you recall that the purple pill, for example, people are still buying because there is knowledge or recognition behind that. So that's what was my first question. Maybe through other IP protections, a patentee can still manage some premium prices once compared with generics. Yep. Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome. David.
Thank you, Professor, and hello, everyone. In the last office hours that we had, Professor Fisher, you mentioned that patents are probabilistic. Patents are probabilistic. Would you please elaborate on this, please, if you could? Thank you.
Yes, it's a good question because it'll provoke some clarification. So by probabilistic, I mean that, I'll pause for a second. I didn't invent this term. This term is circulating in the academic literature, so I don't claim credit for this. But what I and other people mean by the term probabilistic is that a patent is not certain to be valid. It has a certain probability of being valid. Now, in truth, a real property right, meaning a right to land, is also technically a probabilistic asset because there is a chance that if challenged, the title of the title holder would be invalidated because of some prior claim or because of adverse possession or one or the other ways in which a title to land can be tainted. But in most countries now, the probability of invalidation of a real property right is so small that we treat it as a certain asset. By contrast, in intellectual property, and above all in patent law, the chance of invalidation, if the patent is tested in court, is quite substantial. Indeed, of the pharmaceutical patents that are challenged in judicial proceedings in most jurisdictions, the likelihood of invalidation is close to 50%. Now, you should not infer from that that half of pharmaceutical patents are invalid, because there's a selection bias here, a big selection bias, is challengers only go after patents that they think are vulnerable. So it's not the case that only half of pharmaceutical patents are valid. The number is much higher than that, but it's well short of 100%. So that's what I mean by a probabilistic asset. And one of the implications of the probabilistic nature of a patent is that there is a social value to creating opportunities for challenge, because challenges weed out patents that are insufficiently inventive to be socially beneficial. So there's a kind of socially beneficial weeding function that arises from the procedure for challenging patents. And we should be careful about institutional modifications that inhibit challenges. And that's one of the reasons why reverse payment settlement agreements are troublesome from a social welfare standpoint, because they reduce the frequency with which generics press challenges to conclusion.
That's clear, thank you.
You're welcome. Saad. Saad, we can't hear you. I think you're muted.
I said good morning. Thank you for holding your office hours. It's my first time attending. And so I've been with the, I guess, the reading group, Corey Govan, but I'm based here in the United States. I work at the US Patent and Trademark. So I have had quite a number of years of patent prosecution experience. I'm a licensed attorney in Maryland as well. So I'm glad to at least get the refresher on like the 7-8 module refresher we had on patent law. So that was quite refreshing. So my question, I guess, has to do with one of the readings we had. It's the article that was by Jonathan Barrett, and it raised some interesting questions as far as three main question was the hold up, royalty stacking, and one other. So I'll stick with the at least the two. I forgot one. There's one other I think you raised.
Patent holdup, which are related concepts.
Yeah, exactly. So holdup and royalty stacking. And I think the point he was making was most in terms of like the upstream innovators are going to be disadvantaged. And I think that was the thrust that I understood, because essentially he was looking at upstream innovators versus downstream assemblers or downstream manufacturers and how they're going to get advantage. But, and then he was also mentioning to the effect that the vertically integrated companies are less innovative than, say, for example, the upstream innovators. So I was curious, because I think one thing that stood out for me in that article is that, do we have any articles that look at Germany or Korea? Because I'm interested, because here, the two cases that he does mention, and especially in the wireless area, which is what I examine in, he mentioned Qualcomm and Rambus. And I was curious because on the Korean side, we have Samsung, and it's quite a remarkable innovator, and it's a vertically integrated firm. And I was curious if there is any studies out of there that either support what Jonathan Barrett stipulates in his article, or And similarly in Germany, I mean, you do have vertical integrators, integrated firms that are quite big innovators. So it's like Siemens, the other case that we had discussed. So anyways, I mean, I just wanted to get your thoughts. I mean, that was my, the question that I came across. I said that, yeah, he's discussing the US, very, very specific US situation, but is it the case that if we look at the other two big innovators on the global scale, does that hold up? Thank you. I'll take it offline. And thank you for your time. I really appreciate it in advance.
You're welcome. That's a very good and perceptive question. The short answer is no. I don't know of any empirical studies of the patterns of innovation in the analogous Korean and German industries that would either reinforce or undermine Barrett's argument. But it's possible that there is some empirical literature of which I've been aware. So actually, this is I will try to remember to check with my colleague. I mentioned in the recorded lecture Einar Elhage's work. He teaches antitrust law here at Harvard, and he's written some of the relevant literature. And so he would know if there's more recent empirical studies from other jurisdictions than I'm aware. So I'll check with him. It's a good question. So I do want to emphasize that I included the Barrett paper not because I find it myself persuasive on all fronts, but I wanted to give you a juxtaposition of his argument versus the somewhat more prominent and influential arguments by Lemley and Shapiro primarily, which take the position that holdups and royalty stacking are sufficiently serious social problems that we need to limit the availability of injunctive relief to prevent them from clogging the channels with sequential innovation. So Barrett is a retort to that argument. Explicitly a critique of the trend in the United States now that was initiated by the eBay decision to limit injunctive relief. So Barrett over-argues a little bit. On the other side, there's a certain polemical dimension to that article. And my sense is that he and the analogous and the empirical studies that are cataloged in that paper are sufficient to destabilize the conventional wisdom about royalty stacking and patent holdups, but not to undermine it completely. So there is more.
Just to follow, I'm glad that you mentioned injunctive relief. The reason I mentioned Germany and Korea, because I think from our readings, it came across as if in Germany it's easier to get injunctive relief. So if the Barrett's argument would hold up, then you would see the positive effects in Germany as opposed to what we are seeing here with the Lemley's, I guess, take on how it should be done. So,
yes, that's exactly right. And with one major qualification, which is that a universal problem when doing cross-cultural empirical studies of this sort is that there are some confounding variables. The most important is likely to be the work cultures, to put it broadly, of the relevant jurisdictions. So economists in the United States, actually economists around the world, sometimes refer to the tendency of major incumbents, of which Qualcomm would be an example, of engaging in so-called satisficing behavior, which is when not faced with significant competition to relax their innovative energies. That phenomenon, which is well documented, turns out to be to some extent, as you might expect, culturally contingent. And a finding of difference between the US and Korea and Germany on the issue you identify. Unfortunately, it's not going to be rock solid as shining a light on this issue, because it could be rooted not in any difference in the availability of injunctive relief, but rather on the difference in the work cultures in the relevant countries and the tendency within them to press the innovative engine hard. So it's going to be tricky to draw the inference you describe, but it's well worth doing. And to repeat, I will check with Einar to see whether there is any literature of which I'm unaware.
All right, thank you. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Pablo.
Good morning, Professor Fisher. Good morning for everyone. Thank you for your time. I have two questions inside the lecture of this week. First of all, when we talk about the major threats besides COVID-19 and tuberculosis, malaria, HIV, AIDS, what is the philosophy or the construction of the World Bank country classification inside low income, lower middle income, upper middle income, and high income? Because what is the point beside the property law to study that item? And inside that, I believe that is the regulation of the different standard of the WHO, for example, and the regulation that means the confirmation of GATT and the TRIPS. There are different position is about a interstate negotiation, and the second is about the second part of the lecture. Besides, if we have the substandard and falsified drugs that combat the disease inside of all over the world, how we explain the vaccines? Because if we could have vaccines, that is the reason that we have licenses. And if we don't have these licenses, we have the other negotiation items that trips beside. But instead of that, there are other solutions beside the intellectual property item. I know that we talk about in 2 weeks the waiver, but I don't mean that. I only beside the about the public policies instead of the countries. Thank you, Professor Fisher.
Two hard questions. So with respect to the first, as you have noted, I organized part A of the lecture for this week in three levels. First level is describing the incidence and prevalence of major diseases in the aggregate, I mean, over the world at large. Second level is differentiating the four World Bank categories of countries: high, upper middle, lower middle, and low. And the third level is country by country differentiation of the burdens of disease. So burdens of disease as a whole, burdens of disease in the four World Bank categories, and then burdens of disease by country. And you're asking, if I take it, why we pay attention to the middle level at all. What's the significance of what's the analytical or legal significance of the four World Bank categories? I should first emphasize that those categories were not developed to deal with public health. They were developed to deal with a wide variety of economic policies. So this is, after all, the World Bank that created these. And those categories are used to discuss and to prescribe rules pertaining to lots of things, you know, like debt limits and currency and all sorts of other things. So the four categories have been adapted by public health experts to address health. Well, why? Why is this considered relevant? Well, because generally speaking, there's a lot of ambiguity around that, but generally speaking, the resources available to governments and private parties in each country to deal with health challenges vary directly with the wealth of the country, one good measure of which is the World Bank categories. And that means, in turn, that the likelihood of there being serious health hazards tends to go up as you move down the hierarchy. And the capacity of each country to respond to those challenges goes down. So one would expect there to be more serious health difficulties in low-income countries than in high-income countries. And that's true. Overall, that's true. Then there is a prescriptive implication of that observation, namely that when setting policies, most importantly for our purposes, intellectual property policies that affect public health, we should differentiate among the countries because these policies are going to bear unequally on the four categories. And we observe that. So a simple example would be the extension of the application of TRIPS to pharmaceutical products at all for least developed countries, a special category, a subdivision of low income. Okay, that's one manifestation. Another manifestation is when we do get to the TRIPS waiver, the final version of it, adopted roughly a year ago, as you'll see, is only applicable to developing countries, which doesn't map on exactly to the World Bank categories, but it's another effort to set intellectual property policy with respect to the levels. Now, there are limits to this analysis. One of those limits is that the composition of each of the World Bank categories is heterogeneous. And that's one of the reasons why I proceeded in the lecture to the third level and showed you how the disease burdens vary by individual country, which is often, as you saw, more complex than the gross categories of the World Bank. So you get greater precision when turning from the World Bank categories to country by country comparisons. On the other hand, when you move to this more fine-grained analysis, you lose some capacity to appreciate the big picture. Okay, so that's a response to your first question. It's a good question, and you've rightly identified the problematic implications of the lumping of countries into these four groups. So it is useful for some analytical purposes and some policy-making purposes, but you have to be careful with it. Turning to your second question, the problem of substandard falsified drugs is very serious in the world today. You know, one of the grim numbers I included in the recorded lecture is somewhere around 122,000 kids under the age of 5 die every year from falsified, substandard falsified malarial malaria drugs. And it's likely about another 100,000 die because of antibiotics. And in my own work in Malawi and Namibia, we came across using the system I described briefly in the lecture, batches of substandard cancer drugs. So it's a very serious problem. Now, what's the relationship between that problem and local production? Okay, this is tricky, but let's differentiate three rough zones where drugs can be produced. There's manufacture in the United States, Western Europe, or Japan in facilities that are closely supervised by regulatory agencies. In that setting, the creation of substandard and falsified drugs is relatively unusual. It does happen. And there's some scandals recently. There's one in my home state of Massachusetts involving injectables. It was terrible. Okay. So it happens, but it's low. Next category, the production of generic drugs in India, China, and Brazil, which are the biggest, and to some extent South Africa, which are the biggest generators of generic drugs. How often do substandard and falsified drugs get produced there? Well, roughly speaking, it's higher than in the United States, Western Europe, and Japan. Not super high, it varies by manufacturer. There are many manufacturers in India that are just as scrupulous as those in the United States. It varies, but on average, it's a little bit more, one has to worry a little bit more about the likelihood of substandard and falsified drugs coming from those sources. The third of the categories, my dog just arrived in my office here. The third of the categories is production in lower, middle, and low-income countries. And the reason why this is especially relevant, as I think you were suggesting, to COVID vaccines is because there is a strong push now to increase the production of vaccines for COVID and other things in developing countries. This is sometimes known as the local production debate. And I've written in with some collaborators, I've written an article on this issue that you may encounter in your readings, describing the advantages of that approach. Okay, a conventional view in this area is that you would expect the problem of substandard and falsified drugs, if they are produced in lower, middle, and low income countries, to be higher than the problem in India, China, and Brazil. My view is that's not necessarily true. And indeed, the track record of the manufacturers in, let's take a few examples, South Africa, Senegal, and Egypt is very good. And there are other reasons to think that a shift to local production would actually reduce rather than worsen the problem of substandard drugs. Why? It's because often substandard drugs enter the distribution chain because of stockouts. The pharmacies or hospitals run out of drugs they obtain through the regular channels, through the central medical stores. And so what do? Well, they obtain them through irregular channels, sometimes known as black markets. And not surprisingly, the percentages of substandard drugs obtained through the black markets are higher than through the regular channels. So the implication is a shift to local production shortens dramatically the lag between the production of drugs and their arrival in the pharmacies and will reduce the problem of stockouts. And so both because the quality of the drugs produced locally and because of this stockout issue, My view is that shifting to local production could mitigate rather than exacerbate the problem with substandard drugs. So that's a long-winded answer to your question, perhaps more than you wanted, but it's a very big issue. It figures in a larger debate. Here's the larger debate. The extreme inequality in the availability of COVID vaccines across the world has prompted many government officials in developing countries, above all Africa, to some extent Southeast Asia and Latin America, to say, never again will we tolerate a production system that results in depriving us of access to life-saving medicines. We have to reconfigure the manufacturing process globally. One of the retorts, one of the responses to that is, well, but the result will be, if you do that, to exacerbate the problem of bad drugs. So the persuasiveness of that retort is critical to the overarching debate about local production. That's why this matters. So that's a preliminary response. So one of the reasons why we're going to keep coming back to this issue in the next month is that there are other dimensions of substandard and falsified drugs, other ways in which we could suppress them. And because of the seriousness of this issue, we have to keep all of the options in mind. And we've thus far only confronted a few of them.
Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome. Natapo, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes, correctly. Thank you for your time, Professor Fischer. I have a question about the disadvantage of utility model. What is the difference between the patent and the utility model or patent patent? If I'm sure that my invention is novel, non-obvious, and industrially applicable, but I want to obtain the IP right in the faster and cheaper with the same protection as patent. So should I apply for utility model or patent in the Paris Convention system? And what is the required of utility model or patent beside the period of protection time?
Yeah. So that's a very good question. And I have not dealt in this course with utility models at all, primarily because they don't have much bearing with respect to pharmaceutical products, which is our primary focus. So to address your question, the use of and the requirements for utility models vary radically by jurisdiction, much more than the patent system. In some jurisdictions, like the United States, they rarely arise. In other jurisdictions, like China, they're used much more extensively. So it's hard to generalize about utility models because of the wide variation in the manner in which they're deployed. Generally speaking, as you rightly observe, they are easier to obtain and less protective, in part because they last less long. If you have an invention that you are confident would satisfy the novelty and non-obviousness requirements of a regular patent, you should get a patent. Even though it's more costly, in the long run, it's far more powerful. And utility models are less useful in as a foundation for business strategies of all sorts.
But if I want IP protection for maybe just 10 years, and that's enough for me, so it is the same partition between the utility module and the patent?
Well, again, as I say, it varies by jurisdiction, but generally speaking, the scope of the protection you'll get with the utility patent, utility model is also more limited, meaning that the capacity to prevent the entry of competitors through the equivalence doctrine, which shields, as you know by now, a kind of buffer zone around a patent, is less for utility models. So both in duration and in scope, it's less good.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome. So Efrain asks in the chat, can patents potentially be used as a mechanism to distinguish between rewarding the development of drugs that offer important value to society from research and development that yields new drugs without meaningful therapeutic benefits to patients? Yeah, that's a powerful, a fundamental question. Yes, is the short answer. They could be used for this purpose. But they are not, for the most part, currently used for that purpose. So, as you know, an invention, if it satisfies the novelty and non-obviousness requirements, in the pharmaceutical field will enable you to secure a patent even if the drug for which you are seeking protection has no therapeutic benefit over existing drugs. So you can get a patent currently. And more subtly, the scope of the protection that's accorded to the patent using, say, the enablement doctrine or the equivalence doctrine or claim construction does not vary with the social value of the invention. It used to, and it doesn't anymore. So, what devices do we use currently to differentiate what you describe as meaningful inventions versus those that have little or no therapeutic benefit? Well, most of the devices there lie not in the patent system, but in the systems for marketing authorization. So for example, the Food and Drug Administration in the United States, when it confronts a drug that has big potential advantages, will classify it as a breakthrough therapeutic, and as a result, will invest more energy in reviewing it and will do it faster. So at the regulatory level, the distinction you describe does happen. Happens in the United States, happens in Europe, but not at the level of patenting. So as you will see, when we get to the when you get to the recorded lecture on intellectual property reform, one of the arguments that I have been making in this field is to revive some older tools in patent law that would differentiate the scope of socially beneficial patents from incremental patents. But that's an academic proposal, meaning mine. It's not the law currently. So to summarize, the answer to your question, can patents potentially be used as a mechanism to distinguish between rewarding the development of drugs that offer important value to society? Yes, is the answer. Do they do so now? For the most part, no. Now, having said all this, there are a few exceptions, and one of them that we will get to in 2 weeks involves the interpretation of non-obviousness in India. So even though in most systems the differentiation described is not currently made. There are a few jurisdictions where it is, and there was a proposal in Brazil to do so even more extensively. Pratibha.
Good morning, Professor. I have a question regarding the same topic you've been talking recently. Actually, in our seminar, we have been taught about the change in the EPC rules where a particular compound, if have a medicated property, then can be patented. Or if it is found that it can cure a particular disease, then again, patent can be granted. Interestingly, when I was reading the history of patent grants, I came across this particular drug called prontosil discovered by Bayer. And in 1908, when they applied for German patent, the court didn't grant it the patent, saying that this particular compound was already being used in dyeing industry. Therefore, it was already in public domain. So we can see what a great change has occurred in nearly 100 years, where the patent laws have accommodated, or you can say diluted, the concept of novelty to accommodate the what is already there in public domain for the pharmaceutical. My question here is that this dilution of novelty, not just in case of Europe, but also in US, where we have seen that during World War, patent was not given to penicillin, but after World War, it was given to streptomycin. And the question was not about the public health, but the question was about whether the product of nature can be patented or not. So these are the legal questions which has actually, we have come a long way to accommodate this concept of public health versus profit of free enterprise. So this dilution of novelty to accommodate the incremental improvements, do you think it has done great disservice to the drug discovery and development? Because the recent data suggests that more than 60% of the drugs in essential medicine list of WHO are me too drugs. And half of the drugs which are in under drug development are me too drugs. So basically there is less discovery of new drugs, and we are standing at the verge where next pandemic probably would be because of superbug, or what we call as antimicrobial resistance. So this accommodation was done to benefit pharma so that they would do more discoveries, but somehow this is working against the perception of the reason why we were doing it. So what do you think in this regard, and how evergreening is, especially in high income countries, is playing a important role in hampering the drug discovery and development? Thank you.
Pratibha, that was very well put. And I mean, you have a very short answer, which is, I agree. And more detail along the lines that you just very nicely outlined will be coming in the lecture on IP reform in 2 weeks. But the bottom line is, I agree. The observation that you just provide is the starting point for an analysis of how we could readjust the patent system to more tightly align incentives with social benefit. Some of those adjustments involve returning to earlier doctrines that have now been abandoned, but not all of them. Some of them involve adjustments that have never been made before. But we'll get to all of them in 2 weeks.
Okay, Professor. Thank you, sir.
Welcome. Other folks?
So I have one more question regarding the final examination. It's been said we have to write an essay. Can you just tell us the details? What kind of question can we expect? Is it a case study or a scenario, or some recent issue, something? I mean, what are we supposed to expect during examination, and how can we prepare better for that? Thank you.
So I indicated in the little note I included at the bottom of the homepage for the course that I would devote roughly half an hour in the office hours in the next to last week answering any questions about the exam. And I think I should probably wait to do it then, because having made that announcement in advance, it's only fair to ensure everybody in the course has an opportunity to ask questions and get answers. So I think I'll just wait. For the time being, I'll just point you to a little note that also appears at the bottom of the page, namely that the format, the general format of the exam, will resemble that of exam I've given in copyright law previously. So if you want to have a rough sense of what the format's going to be like, just look at that one.
Sure, sir. Thank you.
Welcome. Paola.
Good morning, Professor. Thank you for the opportunity. My question is related to evergreening. The innovator gets the patent protection for the drug, and when this patent expires, it may happen that the innovator protects, like, for example, compositions, polymers, or other products. But at this moment, the active ingredient or the drug can be used freely. So I wonder if the issue of evergreening is related to the lack of knowledge in relation to the scope of the claims from the generic companies?
Sometimes, yes. Meaning sometimes a pharmaceutical firm is able to extend the effective life, commercial life of a drug, not through strategic patenting of minor improvements, but simply by relying upon threats and ignorance on the part of the generics, that if they are not familiar with claim construction, they can hesitate to enter a field where they actually have a right to enter. Now, in most jurisdictions, however, major generic firms have increasingly sophisticated lawyers. And so the ability of a pharmaceutical firm to frighten away generics when their claims actually are, say, limited to dosage is going down. But occasionally it can happen.
Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome. Okay, well, it looks like, as I can tell, no more questions now. So even though we've not exhausted our time, probably stop for today. Looking forward, as many of the questions today have suggested, we are going to be spending basically all of our time from now to the end of the course considering the relative merits of alternative ways of addressing the defects in the current intellectual property regime as applicable to pharmaceutical products, being careful along the way to not kill the goose that's laying the golden eggs, meaning preserving incentives for the creation of socially beneficial products. So next week, the focus is going to be on ways of improving pharmaceutical markets through adjustments in institutions that don't require changing laws. The week after that will be the most heavily focused on intellectual property. And the week after that, we'll be focused on non-IP incentive systems. So we'll be moving back and forth between these families of approaches and comparing their relative merits. That's the plan. And I look forward to continuing the discussion.
Thank you, Professor.
Welcome.
Thank you, Professor.
Welcome.